Thanks for choosing to be with us for today's edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Luann Crane, here with Ryan Dobson. And Ryan, we have a conversation in store today for those who are struggling with a pretty difficult time in their life.
Well, Luann, I've heard my dad say this, and it's true. Every time we come into the studio, we have a certain person in mind. We know that there's someone who has tuned in today who is drowning in grief and pain.
Mm-hmm. It might be because of an unwanted divorce or the death of a child. Could even be an extended period of unemployment. There are just those moments in life when we all just want to throw up our hands and wonder why. Well, that person who's asking that very question is the individual on our hearts today and the one we want to help through this edition of Family Talk.
Well, let's get to it. Here's my dad and our host, Dr. James Dobson, as he introduced our guest for today and tells the story of how God was there for them in the darkest time in their life.
Let's listen in together now to this Family Talk broadcast.
Well, we're going to hear a story today that can only be called unbelievable, and yet it's tragically true. We have two families here who lived it, and their lives have been linked together and changed forever by the events that have unfolded. With us in the studio are Don and Susie Van Ryn and their daughter Lisa. And they live in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Don and Susie helped to run an outdoor youth camp in northern Michigan. Also with us are Newell and Colleen Sarek and their daughter, and we're going to introduce her in just a moment. They live in northern Michigan, where Colleen is a PE teacher and Newell is a youth pastor and has been for 20 years. You have shared your story that we're going to hear today on national television twice, once on the Oprah Winfrey Show and also on Dateline with Matt Lauer. And I saw that Dateline interview, and it was extremely moving to me. And yet some of our listeners did not see either of those programs, and so we need to start at the beginning. Don and Susie, tell us about that phone call that you received that just pierced the night back in April of 2006?
It was in the evening, 10 o'clock-ish. And they first asked if this was the Van Ryn residence, and I said yes. And then he said something about Fort Wayne Hospital, and we have your daughter here.
That is a call every parent fears, isn't it?
Yes. I called down to the phone and said he should get on the other line.
What else did they tell you, Don?
Well, they told us that there had been an accident and that Laura was in critical condition and we needed to come. So that was our next step.
And your daughter, Laura, was how old?
She was 22.
Yes, 22.
Yeah. And so you jumped in the car and you you went to the hospital. What was going on at the hospital when you got there?
Lisa went with us. And Lisa, do you remember first walking in?
Sure. We walked into the lobby at Parkview Hospital and saw a bunch of Taylor students were there and maybe a couple Taylor faculty. And so we sort of greeted them and they were, of course, all concerned and had heard about the accident. And so talked to them first and then we had to wait a little bit until we could get back to see her because they were still doing some things medically back in the ICU with her. So,
how badly injured was she?
A head injury, and she was unconscious, quite badly injured, had some broken bones, and possibly some internal injury. We also had been on the phone all the way down there on the cell phone with other folks, and were able to ascertain that you know, there was a number of people involved in this accident.
Well, tell us about it. Taylor University had sent some students to an event. Explain it.
It was actually the inauguration of a new president, Dr. Habecker, who's there now. And these folks had been up to Fort Wayne. Taylor has two campuses, one in Upland, Indiana, and one in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And so they were up in Fort Wayne setting up the banquet, and then we're on their way back down to the main campus.
Now, they were in a 15-passenger van.
Yes.
And there were how many students on board?
Five students and four faculty, so nine people.
Nine people.
Right.
And what happened?
Well, a semi had crossed the median on the highway and smashed into the van. And it was uncertain at that point how that had happened or what were the
So they were just driving along, right, chatting, talking, as kids will do, and the van came right into it. There was no way to avoid it.
Right. It was one of the four food service ladies was driving the van and had traffic around her as well, and just it was unavoidable.
How many people were killed?
There were five people killed out of those nine. Four were students, and one was one of the food service ladies.
All right, Susie, we haven't heard from you. Can you tell us some more about what happened at the hospital? What you saw, what you felt, other aspects of the story?
Well, what we felt or what we saw seemed just very unreal. And like you say, it's a phone call you never want to get. And we just, you know, prayed constantly since the phone call that she would be alive, that God would preserve her and heal her. And then you walk in and you see your daughter bandaged and hooked up to machines, and
she was not able to talk to you.
Oh no, she was unconscious.
Yeah.
And all you can do is look at that sweet face and I guess thank God that she's there and they're taking care of her, and the rest is in his hands.
We knew also that there was another young man in the van who was a very good friend of our families and of our kids, and so we were quite concerned about him, and we had not heard any word on him, which did concern us. And at some point, we did find out down at the hospital, I believe, through the Taylor faculty, that yes, indeed, you know, five folks had died, and then they identified those folks, and Brad was one of those.
You know, Shirley and I call that a suddenly. You're just going along with your life, and you're doing your work, and you're minding your own business, and then suddenly life changes. And in a way, that happened to you, didn't it? The world fell off its axis.
Exactly right.
Colleen and Newell, your daughter Whitney was involved in the same car crash. How did you find out about the accident?
Well, actually, I was in Mississippi. We had gone down there with a church, part of our church group, and some people from town to work with Habitat for Humanity to rebuild or to build some new homes. And so we were down there for a week, and it was in the middle of the week. And I had been on the phone to Colleen, been talking to separations. Mm-hmm. Was not always our most enjoyable thing, being away from each other. Yeah. So we're talking on the phone, and our the phone beeps a little bit, and I told Con, I said, it must be Carly, but let's just keep on talking. Mm-hmm. So we just kept talking for a while longer, and then I finally hung up, and there was a message left there from Carly that said, Dad, you need to call me right away. There's been an accident, and that's all I got from her. And so So
on my side, when she had tried beeping into us, I ended up picking up the phone call for her. And so she was just in a panic. And Carly at this point was a junior at Taylor, mm-hmm. and Whitney was a freshman at Taylor. So Carly said, Mom, there's been an accident, and Whitney might have been on the van. Just pray. And she goes, I can't talk anymore. Just pray. And so I remember getting off the phone and just pleading with God, you know, just like, Lord, help it not be Whitney, help it not be Whitney. I know that's selfish, but I was just really focusing on mm-hmm. Whitney and not knowing, you know, the immensity of how bad the, you know, and how many people were involved. And mm-hmm. and then our pastor, his name's Jim Mathis, and just came over and he knelt on the floor and just we were just praying for Whitney and just mm-hmm. waiting for that phone call. And Carly had called, and it was about 10 o'clock, and about 10:45, got that phone call, and it was the coroner from Marion General Hospital and also the chaplain from Marion General Hospital had called, and they just wanted to let me know that our daughter had been involved in the accident and that she was pronounced dead, and that could we come down to Marion just to claim her body and to be there.
Did you collapse yourself?
Oh, it's just one of those phone calls that you just, you know, just think you're never going to get. You know, you hear about them and see them on TV, but you just never think that it's going to be you. And the hardest part was that Newell was down in Mississippi with the hurricane, you know, relief stuff. Yeah. And so I just remember having to call Newell, and that was just really, really hard. And just, you know, telling, you know, I'm sorry, Newell. And, you know, just hearing him cry on the other side of the phone was hard.
And immediately you came home, obviously.
Well, what happened was I waited for the call. I had my computer with me, and I got on the laptop and tried to figure out what had happened, and there was no news at that point. But then the phone call came, and I thank God for this. There were a group of men there that were Christian men, and it was very, very encouraging to have them just pray for me. Mm-hmm. They laid their hands on me and prayed, and still the agony of waiting for that phone call. When Colleen called and then said, "No, I'm sorry," and I immediately broke down. Yeah. And then of course I'm so far away from home, and I can't be with my wife. My daughter's at Taylor, Carly's at Taylor, and we're all separated, and it's like we got to get back together.
Yeah. Well, Jim, our friend, offered to drive me down. So we left at midnight that night, and we drove down. It was about a five-hour trip, and we got as far as we got to the hospital. But it was about 5:30, and there wasn't anybody at the hospital at that point. Carly and all the friends and that had been at the hospital had just left about a half hour before that. And so I asked if there was anything that, you know, I needed to do, and there wasn't anything, and it was very quiet. And so we ended up going to where Carly was at her boyfriend's house.
Did they give you an opportunity to see?
You know, they said everything had been taken care of. And, you know, even if they did,
You didn't want to remember.
I didn't want to. You know, I have this amazingly beautiful picture of Whitney in my head. And I'm not good at, you know, scary movies or anything. So I don't like having that other scary stuff. Yeah. And I just didn't want a battered picture of my daughter in my head. Is that my last memory? And so, you know, I probably would have said no, and I did choose, you know, to say no to looking at the body. We had a closed casket for our ceremony, and because I do have this beautiful picture of my daughter in my head. And so we got down to where Carly was, and it was just, again, so important just to be together. And even just driving up, the people that, you know, we had lived in Upland, Indiana for lots of years before we moved to Gaylord, and there were people waiting outside that house, sitting in their car at, you know, at 6 o'clock in the morning just to hug us and love us and, you know, let us know how much they were going to be praying for us during this whole time.
You have now written a book on this subject, all of you have, but in it you talked about the difficulties of the next few days at home without Whitney and after this had occurred. Tell us.
Gosh, where to start? It's just, I mean, even just riding home that first night from Taylor when her roommates had packed all the room stuff up, and we were driving home, and it was just Carly and Newell and myself. And I remember Newell looking out the window and saying, "This is our first sunset without Whitney." And, you know, that was just like the many firsts that were going to come. And I remember we had just gotten back on Thursday night, and Friday morning we had it was just a busy day, and we had woken up, and we had one day to plan the funeral, and so we had gotten home late that night and woke up, and I kind of have, I'm just this type A organizer, and I have 100 things I need to get done and want to do that day, and Carly, who is a junior in college at this point, but just really in love with God, and just said, "You know what? We need to start our day, and we need to pray for 2 hours." And I think I almost laughed out loud. I go, "Carly, I don't have 2 hours." And she goes, "We need to give God the time so he can give us the strength to make through what we're going to need to do." And she took a piece of paper, and she wrote a note and put it on the door and said, "Don't disturb until 11 o'clock. And we started at 9, and still my mind was spinning, but they started it off with that song, "I'll Praise You in the Storm," and that was the first time I had heard it, and the words just, you know, just quieted my soul, and I just felt God starting to wrap his arms around us. And Whitney had just received a Bible from some friends for her high school graduation, and so we knew that the Bible was less than a year old, and one of the things that she had done was underline verses in that Bible, and we had gotten Whitney's Bible out, and we had our own Bibles, and we were just kind of flipping through them, and verses that we had underlined were just popping off the page to us. And I just felt like God was really speaking to us. And the verses that Whitney had underlined were just so special because we knew that that's where her heart was and that she was with Jesus at that point. And we felt like God was speaking to us. And we know that it is. Know his word. This is his word. This is his spoken word to us.
So. You brought today a copy of the program or what was distributed at the funeral. And in it, you have five scriptures that the Lord used to minister to you during that two-hour event. And you've handed it to me. I'm going to hand it back to you and ask you to read the 62nd Psalm that is in the middle of the page.
This is one of the verses that Whitney had underlined in her Bible, Psalm 62, 5 through 8. Find rest, O my soul, in God alone. My hope comes from him. He alone is my rock and my salvation. He is my fortress. I will not be shaken. My salvation and my honor depend on God. He is my mighty rock, my refuge. Trust in him at all times, O Lord. O people, pour out your heart to him, for God is our refuge.
Mm. What a beautiful scripture at a time like that.
Yeah.
Newell, describe the funeral.
The funeral was, the whole feeling was just so surreal. It just seemed like it wasn't really happening, but it was happening, and we were going through the motions of it, but yet there were moments, you know, when we glimpsed the reality of it all, and the planning of the funeral was really difficult. Although we knew in our hearts what we wanted to come across, we wanted Christ to come out of this. Mm-hmm. We wanted that message of the hope that we have in him. And
it's my understanding that that did happen, in fact.
I think not at only this funeral for Whitney, but also the other funerals as well. For all the others that had taken place, there were tremendous messages that had gotten forth and lives were touched. There were many that were very encouraged by the faith of not just one family, but all the families.
I'm so glad Newell mentioned Dr. the other families, because we're acutely aware of the fact that we are not the only ones in this whole situation. Mm-hmm. Our circumstances were very unique, but there's four other families here that have suffered through this just as we have.
What was the vigil like at Laura's side the next few days?
Wow. Constant. They had certain hours when you were allowed to go into the actual ICU, and we took full advantage of all those. As family, we were allowed to go in other times as well. But
there are many people that would like to have been admitted but could not.
Yes, they gave us over the days. We experienced a tremendous influx of friends. Yeah. And family that visited us, and there were half hour periods where we could take other folks. So over all these days in the ICU, there were many that went in to see her.
Susie, in the weeks that followed, did you get your legs under you? Did you come to terms at all, or were you still just terribly broken? I'm sorry.
There were a lot of ups and downs. Times when I would just plead with God to make her better, to heal her. At first, I didn't know whether she was going to live or die.
What were the physicians telling you? What was the prognosis? Did they say she was going to make it?
At first, no. I don't know that they ever specifically said one way or the other.
Yeah, she had brain damage, didn't she?
Dad had said that the first night they told us that she was unconscious, and that she was unconscious when they found her, but that she had been breathing on her own. And I think when they told us she had been breathing on her own, that was a little bit of hope for us. And the next day they said that she was in a coma. And from there, I don't think they ever said, they never told us, we're sure she's going to make it or we're sure she's not in those first few days. But just every little bit of good information that we could hang on to was what we were listening for. And they were very pleasant with us and very informative. And I think they helped us to feel somewhat at ease as much as you can, I guess, in that situation. But
I think for those who do not know this story, and there will be many, but many people do know it, it's time for us to reveal that there is a situation of mistaken identity at this time. In fact, the book is called Mistaken Identity, Two Families, One Survivor, Unwavering Hope, and written by the two families here. And at this stage of the tragedy, you did not yet know, Don and Susie, that your daughter was gone.
Right.
And that Colleen and Newell, your daughter, was alive. And in fact, the one that you thought you were going to the hospital to see and sitting at the bedside of was actually Whitney.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Lisa, we're going to take another program to describe how that understanding came about. But just tell me how in the world this mistake could have been made.
For starters, I think the best answer is because that's the way God wanted it to happen. And that could be the entire answer. But some of the other reasons or what we've thought of later is a few things. For one, they do have similar, Laura and Whitney had very similar physical features, down to their hair and their nails being painted. It's, things like that seemed like Laura to us. Also, like Dad said, we had hundreds of people come to see us and who also went back to see her and didn't question the fact that it was
None
Laura.
None of them picked it up.
You also have to consider, if you can, what that phone call would be like, what you're like sort of emotionally, and you're just hanging on to her getting better. And honestly, we didn't have any reason to doubt that it would be Laura. When you get that phone call or you go to see someone you love in the hospital, you're not checking to make sure that it's her. You're just trusting that she was identified. And
when we got there, it looked like her.
Yeah.
I mean, we
yeah.
just saw the face, the head was all bandaged, and she yeah. had the tubes out of her mouth and everything. And we said, yeah, that's Laura.
I'm holding the book, Mistaken Identity, and the pictures of the two girls are on the cover. And they do look remarkably similar, don't they? And especially after the trauma of
right.
an accident
she
of that nature.
She had some
swelling
in her face and right. some other things, and so she didn't look like herself, per se, like mm-hmm. completely yeah. healthy, mm-hmm. but it looked like her, like Laura. So
the last thing they told us before we went in to see her the first time was, remember, she's not going to look
yes.
like you think she would, you know.
She's not going to yes. look like herself.
Like herself.
And at this point, Whitney was still in a coma.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, we're out of time. I'm going to ask you all to stay right where you are because you flew here for this purpose. We're going to complete the second broadcast now, and then we'll let people hear it next time. Thank you all. I know how hard this is for you. Susie, my heart went out to you when you had trouble speaking. I mean, I cannot imagine it. It would take my breath away to even contemplate it. And the pain is still there, obviously. So I appreciate you all. And Whitney, you've been sitting here quietly this whole time. And I want to hear your story as well. Thank you all. And don't move. But for now, we have to say goodbye to our listeners.
And we definitely invite all of you to return tomorrow because there is so much more to this story. Mm. And I know that those of you who are going through a hard time in life right now will find hope in hearing how the Lord has walked alongside these two families.
Well, in the meantime, stop by drjamesdobson.org where you can get a copy of our guest's book. Again, the title is Mistaken Identity, Two Families, One Survivor, Unwavering Hope. And I'd encourage you to think of a family member or a friend to pass this book on to.
And at that same website, Ryan, we have an article excerpted from your dad's book, When God Doesn't Make Sense. It's called The Adversity Principle. And it really answers that question, why does the Lord allow his people to go through such struggles? Again, you can find information about When God Doesn't Make Sense at drjamesdobson.org.
Or if you'd prefer to call us for the book, Mistaken Identity, or When God Doesn't Make Sense, our phone number is 877-732-6825. And we know you can find those titles elsewhere online, but this reminder that when you request it from us, you're helping to continue to offer help and hope to hurting families. Again, our number, 877-732-6825 or drjamesdobson.org.
And thank you in advance for your support and just for listening today and every day. Please do make plans to return tomorrow for the rest of this conversation with these two precious families.
We'll see you next time on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.